So the Arsenal Bar in San Francisco is a place called Maggie McGarry's, and that's where I typically go whenever the timing works out. And I've discovered for the first time this weekend, I'd never seen it before. There's a sign that says the three footballers not welcome at Maggie's: Roy Keane, Terry Henry, and Stephen Ireland. It's the three people who aren't allowed in.
Wait, why is Terry Henry not allowed?
The 2010 World Cup qualification, handball against Ireland.
Oh, God. Do you remember how that week Clayton was Claytoning, my roommate, Clayton Collins, who I love, had a like very, very small illness, but he was like in true Clayton fashioning, like acting like he had like terminal cancer. And you knew the result. I somehow, against all odds, had managed to avoid the result for like 36 hours.
It was a simpler time.
And I think you were with me. We walk into my apartment and Clayton was watching like Scrubs and like just totally like no decorum, like whatever. We're just like, get out of here. Like we're watching the TV. And he was just like so like sad with like a blanket like over his arm. And we're just like, no. And I had no idea, but everybody was talking about that match. And I had no idea why everybody was talking about that match. But I wanted France to progress. So naturally, I thought that France didn't progress, which like really bummed me out. But then finding out that France did progress, but it was like Maradona style, like really, really made me feel conflicted.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt about it. I wanted France to advance because I thought their team was more talented and more entertaining. But to advance like that, it felt a little dirty. I mean, that's when
that was Shea Given was their keeper, right?
I think so. Shout out Sondico, my first pair of goalie gloves. I want to say that was like one of the main catalysts for getting VAR implemented. Like, I think that it was an idea and a concept before that match. And then like the idea of not going to the World Cup because someone cheated and it's provable and changeable. That really changed the world.
I mean,
really changed the world.
I'd like to think that it was the Lampard goal, but you know, I think enough people the Lampard non-goal, where then everybody like somehow misremembered that match and was just like, England was terrible. They got slashed 4-1. I was like, dude, they equalized and then they had to like play aggressively against the best counterattacking team on the planet, like maybe that dire era. So like, of course they got like, you know, smoked.
That was the same tournament, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was the 2010 finals. Yeah.
Exactly.
Different time.
That was the qualifier and then the final. And I just remember David Beckham just like holding out his hand, you know, like a yard apart. And he was like, the ball was a yard in the goal. Like, what are y'all doing? So I don't know what the conduit was, because if, you know, Argentina and Maradona's success were any indication, like, anything that, you know, hurts England is always going to help the world, but maybe some things are unavoidable. The craziest thing was, you know, FIFA always has, is UEFA too, like always had this kind of tendency of like really being self-righteous about everything in the moment and having control of the situation. And then like 3 weeks later being like, yeah, we're going to change everything up because that was really bad. There was almost this like 12-hour window where we didn't think it was going to happen, but we thought there was like a 40% chance based on the messaging coming out of UEFA and FIFA that like somehow they're going to finagle a way for like Ireland to play like somebody else for a spot. Remember how bizarre that was?
Oh yeah, there was definitely talks of replays and stuff like that. Like they were trying to come up with alternative solutions left and right, and then ultimately just let France go.
At least Ireland is not notorious for their drinking.
No comment.
I don't know how I would have handled that. I don't know how I would have handled that, man. But yeah, we got VAR. And love it or hate it, it seems to be here to stay. So ignored kung fu kicks at the end of title deciders aside.
There was a VAR decision in the Spurs match on Saturday or Sunday. against Luton Town. And I think it was the closest I've ever seen a ball to being in, not being in. Like, mm-hmm. I think it was millimeters.
Yeah.
So in that instance, VAR, at one point the commentator even said, I can't wait for this VAR review graphic because of how close it was. And it was.
Yeah. And
so at that point, VAR was compelling.
I don't know the name of the young chap who did clear that ball, but had he put his boot on it a millisecond later, it would have been a goal. And the entire race for the top four would have been radically different. But on another note, and I'm sure we'll be at some point, probably later in the season, explaining in great detail what may make the fifth place team in the EPL a European qualifier. For now, the race for fourth place rate is on because Manchester City has avenged their loss to Aston Villa earlier in the season, which at the time, I think was fair to characterize as the most comprehensive ass-kicking by any team to Pep Guardiola's Manchester City side. Was it not?
Yeah, in December, I think that was the best I've ever seen someone control Man City. Not so much on Wednesday.
A comprehensive ass-kicking this time around of Aston Villa behind Phil Foden, who very quickly is becoming... I mean, I hate to say it with Kevin De Bruyne in that midfield, but he seems to be their most valuable asset as far as attacking options go, with Erling Haaland. Last podcast I said he wasn't Kylian Mbappe, which is like saying somebody's not Michael Jordan, and that being intended to be a slight. But that's the incredibly high bar that Haaland had set. And, Roy Keane took it in an entirely another direction after the Arsenal match. He said he was, did you read this quote?
Yeah, I saw it.
He said he was a League Two striker.
Yeah, and I also saw Pep's retort, which was to suggest that Roy Keane was a Division Three or Four manager then, probably.
Did he really say that?
Yeah. So, call that one even.
What do you think? What do you think is more accurate?
I would say that Roy Keane being a lesser than manager is a little bit more accurate than calling Haaland a League Two player. But I think there was merit to some of his critique. I think that's always been part of a critique of Haaland's game, is that he doesn't get involved in the build up and link up enough. I think he's got a little bit more than Roy Keane thinks he has. But it definitely feels like he's kind of the in game for their attack rather than part of the real footballing flow of it all. And I think that was apparent against Arsenal. And of course he didn't play against Aston Villa. So we'll see him next week against Real Madrid and see how he handles that.
But I mean, that's been the theme of, I think, the last month, maybe 2 months, is that, you know, Haaland has thrived playing for some very direct sides. I wouldn't say Dortmund's like very direct, but like they're very attack minded. They're not necessarily a side that like wears you down with possession and will pass you to death and then find the ultimate through ball. Like, you know, they're a sophisticated side, but, you know, there's a certain directness there that isn't there with City. And he has not been surgical. He's not been surgical with his head. He hasn't been surgical with his feet. And League Two is obviously an insane thing to say, but I wouldn't say so in the Arsenal match, but earlier matches, you know, maybe the Liverpool match, I think, would be the most shining example. There are some headers that he missed that really like could have tilted that fixture on its head.
Yeah, I think that he maybe hasn't had quite the finishing prowess this season that he had last season. His non-penalty goals to expected goals certainly reflects that. I mean, last year he was finishing like a madman, and he's taken a slight step back in that category. But yeah, to suggest he's League Two is a little bit silly. But you were right. Like at Dortmund, he was kind of a part of a jailbreak attack at times and found himself in loads of space and just gobbling it up because he's 6'2 and fast as lightning. And with Man City, it just requires a little bit different skill set. Last season, he obviously was nearly flawless. And to take a step back from a record scoring campaign is going to invite some criticism from some folks, but at the same time, like, he's still the leading scorer in the league. I think it's going fine. What it's going to do is just going to piss him off, and he's going to score like 10 goals in the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, which he kind of has outside of the Premier League. But why do you think that is? Because this is something that I've really always kind of, even though I've really tried to study this sport on a granular level, you know, for the last 20 years. You know, it seems like, you know, tactics are a sophistication that extends beyond like watching quote unquote like game tape and like American football, basketball. You know, odds makers put him as the favorite to break the all-time record for goals in a Premier League campaign last year, and he exceeded those expectations. I mean, his first year in the Premier League, he set the record for most goals ever scored by someone in the Premier League. We can point to a lot of reasons for why this year there could have been a regression that have nothing to do with Erling Haaland. Injuries, you know, maybe a bit of a transition in terms of the personnel that's around him and how there's been a certain learning curve with them to adapt to Pep's system, which can be reflected in their performances this season, which again, like they're playing really, really, really well. I think we're kind of doing City a disservice to say, and this is one area where I would agree with Pep, like Pep said over the weekend, like there's a bit of, you know, kind of false nostalgia about City's last campaign and maybe previous campaigns too. Like when you win this much over this period of time, people try to pretend or people misremember and think that like every match was like 5-1 or like 3-0 or like 7-2. And like that's not the case. And that's not to say they weren't dominant, but I say all that to say that this City side has seemed the most fragile. And it seems to me that if you had to like judge it from the cheap seats, Pep is playing the most ambitious version and the most natural evolution of his system with players who are largely the least either capable, and again, like these are all world-class footballers. Like these are all amazing players. I'm just saying, like when you're grading against the curve, you know, like you look at the back line's not the best back line of all time. The midfield is either aging or hasn't necessarily reached the sweet spot yet. Doku and Grealish are not necessarily even Mahrez and Sterling or Jesus. Like it seems like they're almost inviting the kind of frailties and making themselves susceptible to the type of, you know, moments of being dominated by their sides, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. I say all this to say, I don't think that Haaland's regressing because people have like a year of tape on Haaland and know what he's going to do. But I don't think that like he's allowed to play like neat little number nine zone with everything else being perfectly buttoned up this year the same way he had last year. Or do you think there's like a larger theme in play? Like, is he just sloppier? Like, are there other things? Like, is he just like not playing as well? And like, we're kind of overthinking the larger context.
I'd lean more towards the latter. I would be curious if, I think the team flow has definitely taken a step back. I mean, there were times last season where we were watching one of the best teams of all time. They were plain and simple, unbeatable, and they, towards the end of the season, were creating chances at will. Basically, it felt like that has not quite been the case this year, but their chance creation is kind of the same. I'd be curious if those chances are coming from the same places. Last year, he had basically ESP with De Bruyne. Like some of those goals we remember where he's kind of like flying through the air, or, you know, it feels like he's almost teleporting into position to make the final touch. Kevin De Bruyne is like the only player in the world that can see that and execute those passes. Him being injured for a long time was probably super detrimental. But again, like this is the first season he's had below average finishing. Like he's closer to Darwin Nunez and Nicholas Jackson than he was his standards from last year. So I don't know. I wonder if maybe he's been carrying an injury at certain points. It is curious. We saw like an absolute comet last year come into the league, and I think he's still got a lot of that capability. He's still going to be one of the most important players in the Champions League matchups with Real Madrid, etc. Just so happens the last time out we saw him, he was going up against Gabriel and Saliba, who have pretty much pocketed everybody they've played with this or against this season. I'm not panicking or insulting Erling Haaland at this point. I just think it's one of those things where maybe this is more of his natural state than 42 goals or whatever it was. And that's perfectly fine. Again, he's leading the Premier League and the Champions League in goals.
Yeah. I mean, let's not attack a human for having human moments while still being like the biggest badass alive.
Yeah. And I think the one thing that does stick, like I said, with Keane's criticism is like, if there's a critique to be made about his game, I think that it's, he's not as involved in the like quote unquote football side of things. Like he's not as involved in between the boxes as certainly traditional Pep Guardiola strikers, probably most people's preference for strikers, i.e. like we'll see Kane up against Gabriel and Saliba this week in the Champions League. And that's going to look completely different because he's going to go find the game and get out of space. Whereas Haaland is like, he's a battering ram. And he's probably the best in the world at that. It's just he has a different little bit of a skill set. And, you know, if Roy Keane doesn't want to play with him, then guess what, Roy Keane? You don't have to play with him.
Let's dig into the Arsenal match because I think it was extraordinarily telling because this was one of the few – because people have always kind of posited that what Mikel Arteta is doing is a more advanced version of what Pep's doing, albeit with slightly – let me reemphasize, slightly inferior players.
Less expensive.
Less expensive. And I think that, like, if that's the case that's being made, I think that this was 90 minutes, or maybe the first 60 minutes of this match probably would be, like, the best example of that. Because Arsenal defended extraordinarily well. I mean, there are so many times that you are used – over the last 6-7 years to watching City get into the box and make that pass and try to do, you know, their version of the Pep tiki-taka, you know, dribbling, you know, finding lanes where you didn't think existed. And it was just continually, it didn't matter whether it was Saliba, it didn't matter, you know, whether it was Declan Rice tracking back. It just didn't matter who it was. Like, somebody was stepping up and putting a boot in and making a tackle. Like, I've never seen a team feel so confident, and I've never felt a side feel so safe with Manchester City inside their box. Like, you know, you get scared, and then after the fourth or fifth tackle or, like, the sixth or seventh clearance, you're just like, they're not getting in there. And I'm trying to figure out, looking back at the first half of the match, what Arteta's decision-making was for the second half of the match, because a lot of the forwards on Arsenal's side, you know, mainly Saka, to a lesser extent Jesus, you know, and again, like, I don't know what to make of Kai Havertz on any given day, but like, my gut says they didn't play well. And if they did play well, this would have been a fundamentally different match. And I know we had said going into it that the odds were somewhat dumb, that City was favored so heavily and that Arsenal were massive dogs. And I don't want to act like, you know, they were playing Fulham. I don't want to act like they're just playing some like middling EPL team. But I do feel like if their forwards had played better and not played borderline like poorly, it's hard to disagree with a lot of the match ratings I saw that like saw like Saka is like a 5. Like, Arsenal could have bossed this match. And I don't want to – I specifically want to point to a guy like Odegaard though and like cover him from that critique, because like that dude tracked back, that dude was everywhere. That dude was like the extra body that needed to be the extra body to clog everything when they needed to be. But like beyond that, I know this was probably the result Arteta wanted. I know this is a result that Arsenal fans were more than satisfied with. But you, like, deep down, despite not wanting to be greedy, did you not feel like in some way this was a lost opportunity to get 3 points at the Etihad because like your forwards just like kind of weren't as sharp as they typically are?
I'm curious about other people's takes on it more because for the most part, coming out of the game, everything I was hearing from impartial observers or neutrals with the game was very boring. I didn't feel that way because I was on pins and needles the whole time. So I was watching through a strange lens.
I didn't think it was boring at all.
I didn't think it was boring at all either.
I like the first half, I kept waiting for somebody to settle in and nobody settled in. And then it just kind of felt like the balance of the match was going to shift to Arsenal. And it just like never did.
Yeah.
And I remember like Partey coming on and I remember Trossard coming on. And I was just like, this is exactly what I would do if I was Arteta. These are two dudes that like can create link up play, that are responsible, that can possess the ball, but also will track back, will find space. Like, you know, Martinelli, like as well. Like, again, like I'm not second guessing the lineup at all. I'm not second guessing the starters at all. Like, I think Jesus played really, really well, all things considered. But I almost feel like City was able to camp in Arsenal's final third for the last 30 minutes because Arsenal just didn't play that dangerously throughout the first two-thirds of the match. So Pep was just like, screw it. Like, we'll overload them, and we're City. Like, we're playing at home. Like, they're Arsenal. They're going to crack. And they didn't. But, like, every time they're making a pass in the box, like, it was this very helter-skelter emotional, like, up and down, because it was just like, this is where they score. This is where, like, the dream ends. This is where they score. This is where the dream ends. And then it's just like, why am I doubting Arsenal? Like, these kids are just blocking everything. Like, they're just where they need to be. Like, it reminded me of the closest analog I can think of was watching Chelsea play Barcelona in the Champions League down a man in that second leg. And it was just like, I was conditioned to think that Barcelona was eventually going to break through. But Chelsea was so incredibly efficient, and like nobody was going to give an inch. And eventually you're just like, no, I think they got this. And that's how I felt about Arsenal. Like, after about like the 78th minute, like, even though City was like living in Arsenal's box, I was just like, I think Arsenal's got this, dude. Like, I think City's frustrated, beyond frustrated.
Yeah, I think it was obviously a lot of hard work, but it kind of felt like there was just no path for City. And I think that, to go back to the beginning, I think Arsenal set out to defend. Like, I think they were planning on letting Man City have the ball. I think they were happy to sit back in a mid to low block, much the way that teams have defended against them and given them trouble. They were trying to do that to Man City's possession game. And I think that, you know, Man City had the impetus to win this game. Like, a draw is a much better result for Arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that approach shows far more of the Moyes school than the Wenger school that Arteta takes from. But I don't think that they set out for it to be to that degree. And for the first, at least half, Man City was all up in their kitchen. They just couldn't get that final 12 to 15 yards and in the middle of the field was completely blocked off. But other than that, Man City was doing what they wanted to him. And I thought Jesus actually was one of the better defenders on the field. And Saka was just really isolated. But when they broke out, there was just a complete lack of composure. And I don't know if it's because, I mean, Man City's defense was great too, and they had him completely pinned in. But yeah, there was like this sense of almost like, here's our one opportunity. We better do it now or never. And they did rush a lot of trying to get out from the back. And then, you know, nothing was really paying off. I think they just kind of came to terms with the fact that we're going to play for a draw. Then, I mean, to give even more credence to that, Pep is the first one that made the sub. Like, I think Arteta was happy with the game state as it was before the Doku Grealish subs, and then everything kind of started to shift. And I think at that point, when you put Trossard on, I was hoping he was going to play Martinelli because they just needed someone to run into that space behind. There just wasn't enough of like a pacey threat on those counterattacks. But
because that's what I was wondering about, because Martinelli, you know, was wearing the trainer, like he was running up and down. Like, I felt like Arteta really was kind of having the soul searching moment between like being a pragmatist and being a romantic. And he ultimately was like, I'm not going to concede at the Etihad in the 80th minute because I'm trying to be cheeky. And I feel like that's kind of emblematic of not just how Arsenal as a team has grown up, but how like Arteta has grown up, like in terms of just being a shrewd tactician and seeing the bigger picture.
Yeah. And I feel like it's a missed opportunity in the sense that I wish Arsenal in the attack would have been a little bit more patient. And I think that Arsenal had the better chances, probably the better three or four chances.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Honestly,
not even close.
But their chances weren't exceptional. And I think coming out of that game, I was watching with a bunch of Arsenal fans and everybody was pretty contented with getting out of there with a draw. I thought it was I don't think they got lucky at all to get that. And it was a really impressive performance. And just move on to the last 10 games of the season. I mean, they shut out Man City in both matches this season. They shut out Man City at the Etihad, which hasn't been done for like 50-something games. Mm-hmm. And they went undefeated against Pep and Klopp this season. And a lot of that has to do with the pragmatism of Mikel Arteta. Like, they learned from last season when they were trying to steamroll teams, and they've become far more patient and determined defensively. And this was kind of like the crown jewel of that. Like, no, they didn't win at the Etihad. There's another step to be had to take where they can roll in there and go toe-to-toe with Man City or dominate them even. But considering the circumstances, I think they were very grown up in their approach, and I think they executed it to a T.
Yeah, so like, let's zoom out. Arsenal did not concede against Liverpool or Manchester City in this campaign.
They conceded to Liverpool, but they did not lose.
Yeah. They did not give up points in matches against City or Liverpool this campaign.
Do you know the list of managers who have done that against Pep and Klopp in the same season?
I mean, I would imagine like nil, but please tell me who.
Mikel Arteta. That's the list.
And this is a guy who is managing Arsenal, who for better or for worse, historically do not have that tendency. And that's because of the style they play. That's why we've always loved the Gunners. That's because, you know, they play an exciting brand of football. And unfortunately, you know, Wenger was eclipsed in some ways by the likes of, you know, Jose Mourinho and Alex Ferguson. And people considered that style of play to be outdated for people who were more willing to pack it in for extended periods of time. But on their day, and as we've seen recently and throughout the entire season, these kids are, I guess we now should say these men, will put up like 5 goals on the reg. Like, it's they are as capable of putting it in, you know, the first gear as they are the sixth gear of any side of the modern era, and that includes Manchester City. Which I think is why they're uniquely equipped for Champions League success, which we'll touch on later. But if you could, as an Arsenal fan, and I know that, you know, we're recording this on a Wednesday, we're just going to assume Liverpool takes care of the Blades, and by the time you're listening to this, are top of the table. But
that feels pretty safe.
I think it's pretty safe. If you're an Arsenal fan, you know, Liverpool accruing this many points despite all the injuries and playing like the first 12 matches with like 9 players every other match aside, I think you'd probably take this place in the table, especially with your matches with Liverpool and City behind you.
Oh, yeah. I think Liverpool's obviously the most excited by the weekend's result in the current table. I think Arsenal's perfectly content with the situation. Shockingly, I think Man City is probably the one kind of starting to feel a touch of desperation. I think Liverpool and Arsenal both, A, think that they can run the table, and B, think that the other one will probably slip up. And Man City is going to need a little bit more help than that.
Yeah. So, you know, and this is again, before Liverpool plays the Blades, but again, based on current odds, they're like, you know, 97% favorites to win that match. This is what FanDuel is currently offering in terms of odds to win the Premier League. And I think this is a great disservice to Arsenal, especially given their past performance.
They're third favorite, aren't they? I don't get it.
Yeah, and I think this is a tremendous, and I know that we're going to talk about bets later on, but, you know, in the same way that the Lakers and the Cowboys are favored in Vegas sometimes by an extra point or two just because of the brand, I don't know how to reconcile that Liverpool's plus 120, Manchester City's plus 135, and Arsenal are plus 240. Like, I don't get that at all.
I would need to dive a little bit further into the fixtures, I think. I think that Arsenal's got maybe some tougher road games, but I don't know. I remain very impressed with Arsenal. I still think they're the most complete team. The fact they haven't done it before, I guess, is working against them so strongly. And Liverpool's in first place.
Yeah, but what is doing it before? This isn't the NBA where you like this isn't like playing in the Super Bowl. This isn't like playing in the World Series. Like, this is a 38 game round robin competition, and 3/4 of the way through, in terms of known commodities, like I feel like they're the most valued bet because, like, yes, Liverpool will be in first place should they take care of Sheffield United. But is Arsenal not the most like sentient being in terms of knowing what they are, knowing what they're capable of, like adaptability, like, and they don't have any team remaining in their fixture list that they won't be favored against.
Right.
So we can talk about adaptability. We can talk about matchups. We can talk about all this stuff. Like, again, like, assuming any team will not drop points for 10 matches is always just kind of an asinine proposition. But what are you banking on when you're saying that, like, they're plus 240 and Man City is plus 135? When we've already seen the sides that Man City has struggled against, not only drop points to.
I think that Arsenal's got some tougher road fixtures, and then there's this Klopp magic that's happening, and then Man City is obviously this grand behemoth. But I just take that value bet. I don't know. Every time I keep coming back to this, I know there's not as much separation in the table. I just think Arsenal's better than these teams based on what I see. Not only head to head, but in general, like,
yeah,
I don't know.
We're not talking about ceiling, because if you talk about ceiling, I think any sane person would have to say, like, Man City's ceiling is the highest. They just haven't consistently demonstrated it. I think, like, if you're taking the aggregate of what any of these teams displays on a regular basis, and you're kind of averaging that against their best performances, you know, given the fact that this is a sport that dictates you play quite a bit, you rotate to some degree, it's really hard to make the case that anybody other than Arsenal is the best team in Europe right now. Like, I'll listen to other arguments, but, like, I fundamentally disagree with anybody saying, I don't care whether it's Real Madrid, I don't care whether it's Manchester City, I don't care whether it's Liverpool. It's really hard to say that Arsenal isn't the best team in Europe right now.
Yeah, let them keep playing the underdog. I don't think anybody in the game is underestimating them. We keep hearing these coaches talk about how complete and thorough they are in every phase. But yeah, let the doubters doubt it and rack up the value money, because I completely agree. I think Arsenal's the best team. The knock on them has always been their youth and inexperience in these situations. They got that experience last year. They're another year older. And I think that they've shown this season going to Anfield and the Etihad and getting draws that they've grown up a little bit, both the result and the performance itself. I tend to agree with you. But I will say one thing about the Arsenal-Man City match is there's a really good chance that these two teams play each other again for 180 minutes in the Champions League semifinals, which would be, I don't even know what to think about that. It would be unbelievable, because that game at the Etihad was so tense. Just like every single individual action felt like there was so much tension in it, and add the Champions League situation to that. But if that were to pass, I think that it's on Pep to make the adjustment. I think Arsenal was comfortable with that, you know, that position.
Agreed. And we'll talk about the Champions League in a second. But before we move on, I want to, as much as I don't want to, I do feel like we've reached a, pun intended, fever pitch here. And even though Pep is almost begging us to talk about it, I think that I'm going to call his bluff and say he actually doesn't want us to talk about it. Arsenal is a very harmonious dressing room, I would presume.
Seems that way.
Liverpool, even if you're Cody Gakpo, I presume has a very harmonious dressing room.
Maybe even more so with the Klopp scenario.
Absolutely.
Like, he seems like a like older brother, less than like a dad figure like Arteta, Guardiola.
100%. I fail to see the value in the public dressing down of a player like Jack Grealish, who less than 12 months ago said, I finally feel like a Manchester City player. I'm starting to get the system. I felt like an imposter. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. I felt like an imposter when I got here. This is a guy who's recovering from injury. This is a guy who was gutting it out to be adaptable and play this match where he was desperately needed. And, you know, I've spent most of my life being quite cynical about Pep Guardiola. And over the last couple of years, especially with the Champions League win last year, I've said, you know, it's somewhat undeniable to at least, you know, concede what Pep's achieved and what he's trying, how he's trying to push the game forward and all these things. It's just kind of a regressive mentality to point out his shortcomings.
He's not infallible, though.
But this was one of those moments where it was just like, dude, what are you doing? And this isn't the first time. It won't be the last time.
It's definitely not the first time.
But what's the point? What's the point of going after somebody like Jack Grealish so intensely with all the cameras in the entire world to see, especially under the incredibly hot spotlight that is the Etihad, and just like not even dressing him down, but just like going to town on him. And then like he tries to like pull this almost like Machiavellian trick when he's addressing the media afterwards, saying like, well, I do it for the cameras, clearly. It's like, dude, I'm calling your bluff. Like, I know you think that you're like baiting us into not talking about it by saying that, but like, I'm calling your bluff. What are you doing? Why did that need to be in public? What does Jack Grealish gain by being talked to that way by you in that setting? Because I don't think anything.
Yeah.
What's the point?
I don't either. I'm glad you mentioned this because it drives me nuts when I see him like out on the field, almost like a little league manager. Like, it's so condescending to like do this to a professional player. And I remember he did it earlier in the season to Haaland, and it was like about a specific run that he made or something. And Haaland was just like, okay, dude, like maybe not here. And it, I don't know, it just feels so performative and lame.
Yeah, like even Haaland was like staring at his boots and was just like, bro, like this can wait, right?
It's like, dude, I just ran 10 miles, like lay off it. Can I handle this in a few minutes? It's just, it feels like it's for Pep and it's really, really lame. And like, he's above a lot of criticism, but sometimes he does this kind of stuff and it's just, it's so preventable and it's an unforced error and it just feels so like forced and lame.
Yeah.
Also to do it to Grealish, who's like very obviously a confidence player. It's like, whatever. Miss me with a Pep. Miss me.
Yeah. And again, like I hate to compare it to American sports, but like for all the college football fans in there, like this reminded me of literally like when Kirby Smart used to like grab Stetson Bennett by like the shoulder pad and like the neck and just like scream to his face at him and like in midfield at halftime. And it's just like, dude, like you think you're like proving a point by doing this in public. And it's just like, you're not proving a point to anyone. Like you just look like an asshat. You're embarrassing your player who is clearly like not, you know, mailing it in. He just didn't do it to your satisfaction or up to the way you wanted him to. And to some degree, like, that's your responsibility for, like, failing to inform him or failing to put him in a position to succeed. Like, why are you scapegoating Jack Grealish after this match?
This kind of extends to the reason the main thing I disliked about his Barcelona teams, and it came up again this weekend, is that this Man City team as well tries to play this, like, holistic, pure football and acts holier than thou and above the dirty sides of the game, i.e. tactical fouls. And when the going gets tough, this used to happen with Barcelona too, they would be the first ones to go run to the referee, or they would be the first ones to implement tactical fouling. And Akanji was complaining about it. Haaland posted videos on its Instagram about it. And it's like, sorry, I know you played a team that can finally go toe-to-toe with you, but, like, you play with Rodri and Bernardo Silva, who's probably the greatest of all time at tactical fouls and getting away with it. And I just have absolutely no time for it. It's super irritating to act holier than thou when in reality or in practice, they're just like the rest of us. And I don't blame them for trying to manipulate the referee or fouling in certain scenarios.
You just can't have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah, it's just don't act like you're better than that. Exactly.
Like, don't be like Sergi Busquets, like rolling around on the ground and then like opening your eyes to see if the referee is noticing. Like, are you really telling me that Fernandinho. Like, was there because of how fast he was? He was there because of how...
Sorry, Fernandinho 1, Bernardo Silva 2. That's right.
Fernandinho was literally the king of tactical fouls. Like,
yeah.
He got away with murder. Like, I don't think people understand. Like, the guy, you know, if FIFA was rating him accurately, he had a 55 pace. Like... And then Rodri came in, and we can talk about favoritism. We can complain, you know, we can, you know, point at the top of the table and say they won because of this reason and that reason. And obviously it wasn't because they could commit tactical fouls, but it certainly did not hurt. And it's at the end of the day, like I don't want to, again, sound holier than thou as a fan, but it's just like, just kind of a bummer. Y'all are so good that, like, you don't have to do this to win, but, like, if you did this to win, like, just don't be so, like, again, like, holier than thou about it. Like,
no, that's the difference, is that I would admit that I'll resort to that stuff. They won't.
I remember comments that, like, Xavi made back when, like, you know, it played Arsenal and in the Champions League, and he's like, we expected more of Arsenal than, like, you know, being so chippy in the midfield. And it's just like, dude, like, Nasri, like, breathed on you and you, like, rolled around. Like, come on. Like, you lost 2-1 against a really, really great side in London. Like, do you really, really need to, like, feel that much better about yourself by saying that, like, you know, they hacked you to hell? Like, that's just not the situation. And it's just kind of an ongoing theme with Pep Guardiola's sides.
Totally agree. I will say one thing nice, since we've been bashing them, is I like in the reverse, and it also seems kind of secondary. I like that Rodri tucks his shirt in, because I think that if you were to reverse the tables on him, it becomes a point where a tactical foul on him is very, very obvious. So I do think that's smart, and I think it's on purpose.
But you can't decouple that from the fact that you like the fact that he tucks his shirt in, because it gives you, like, massive retro vibes that you respect.
No, there's very few shirt tuckers left, so I'll take what I can get. I'm not excusing him for all of his certain behaviors through the middle of the field whenever he's too slow.
You know who were the last great shirt tuckers? It was, like, the Zanettis and the Cambiasos at Inter Milan.
Oh, Zanetti was great, yeah. And he's a classic shirt tucker.
Those two, the Argentinians that played at Inter Milan, they were riding the shirt tucking fad until the very end. They were like, you can't untuck our shirts.
You know who's a new shirt tucker? Is Indrik tucks his shirt in and pops the collar.
No.
Big time. Big time shirt vibes, yeah. Oh, yeah. Look out for that one.
So when aliens are watching the sport, they're going to, like, realize he's an all-timer.
He at least looks like one.
Okay, fair enough. Well, we're gonna jump onto some Champions League stuff really quickly, and then we'll jump into our bets, our props for scores of the week, and what we're watching. Okay, so we got our massive first legs, the Champions League, this week. I don't want to analyze this to death, but given each team's style of play, I do want to analyze each fixture and see what's considered a success if each side has to take the return fixture.
Okay, I like that. I like that that framing of it.
Because there are a lot of fixtures here where, you know, because we're living in the post away goals rules era. So this is a fundamentally less complex exercise. And, you know, we can kind of suss out what each team's gauging as a success. I'm going to start with Arsenal Bayern. This first leg's at the Emirates. I think Arsenal is probably going to play pretty cautious because they're trying to get a feel for Bayern, but I think Arteta's not going to be too cautious once they get a sense. I think Arsenal's gunning for a win here. Are they not?
My prediction is that they're going to smell blood in the water. I think they might take the first, you know, 15, 20 minutes lightly or cautiously, but I think they're going to realize pretty quickly, or at least I hope, that I don't think Bayern has that gear this year, and I think Arsenal can take pretty solid control of this tie while at home at the Emirates. I don't think Bayern can keep up with them. I think that they, if it's a stodgy game, I think Arsenal's got more organization. If it's a transitional game, I think they're more physical and athletic. I think Arsenal has the better players, not to say anything negative about Bayern's. I think they've got players to hurt you, but I just think that Arsenal's the better team, and having the first leg at the Emirates, a draw is the absolute bare minimum, but I think that once the game starts to unfold, they might sense an opportunity that we're better than them and we can get two or three here.
People always try to talk about the signing of the season. They try to analyze it in a clever way, and I always say the obvious answer is not necessarily the wrong one. And given that both these sides were competing for the signing of Declan Rice, I think he alone may not be the decision maker in this tie, but he's certainly a huge factor in why Arsenal's midfield is going to have the brute strength to just walk over Bayern. I mean, I don't want to say Bayern sucks because they don't suck, but Arsenal's better, man. Like, Arsenal's better in every way. We can talk about keepers. And yeah, I'll give Neuer the edge.
It's closer than it looks.
But in what way, other than us just looking at brands and us just thinking about conditioning and us just looking at history and us just crawling through, you know, Tuchel's past successes in two-legged fixture. I mean, you know, we can look at all the intangibles. But at the end of the day, like, the intangibles are only a small piece of the pie. Like, Arsenal's better than Bayern Munich. Arsenal is better than Bayern Munich by every way that you can tangibly measure a side against another side. Is that too harsh, or am I just cutting through the noise?
No, I mean, Bayern's taking a step back, obviously. I just think Arsenal's that good this season. I think we've had a few moments this season where Bayern was supposed to answer the bell and finally kick into gear. They haven't done it. I just don't think it exists. I don't think that mentality is there for them this season. And I think Arsenal, they need to be careful, obviously. Like, Kane, Sané, etc. Musiala is kind of this little cheat code. They can hurt you at any point. And if they get an early goal, then it changes everything. But yeah, I think slow and steady wins the race for Arsenal here. And they can punish them 2 to 3 goals and go to Allianz and shut it down.
Yeah. But I mean, let's break it down. And again, you know, I've been at the Etihad for their montage of greatest goals ever. And Sané has more than you would expect among that top 25, that top 20, whatever they show. But I just don't ever find him to be particularly clutch. And that might be a hot take. There might be something that I'm missing, but I've just seen him bungle more opportunities than I've seen him put away. And you look at Saliba, you look at Gabriel, I just don't think they're going to have a tremendous amount of difficulty with him. Obviously, Bambi can pull a rabbit out of a hat. You never want to discount Musiala from anything. He obviously saved their season last year, and Kane can create something out of nothing. But as an entire unit, like, I would take Arsenal's backline, and then you put Declan Rice in the picture in terms of somebody who's tracking back in a true four role. I just really don't see them, you know, being taken by surprise, put out of position. I don't know. And on a completely unrelated, semi-related note, is Harry Kane not the most cursed football player of all time? Like, he leaves Tottenham to win trophies. He goes to Bayern. He's breaking all kinds of records. And I don't think he's going to bag a trophy this year. Like, what does this man need to do to win a damned trophy?
I was wondering when that was going to get brought up. Yeah, that's a pretty ironic turn of events to go to Bayern Munich and suddenly they don't win for the first time in a decade. And that's a little insult to injury. He's now behind pace to break Lua's record in the Bundesliga. So it's all kind of crumbling apart at the end.
He's like the anti-Tom Brady. Like, what is he doing? I mean, eventually the Colts will win the Super Bowl, but when will Bayern are we just assuming at this point that, like, once Xabi leaves Leverkusen for Liverpool or maybe even Bayern, that, like, Harry Kane's going to win a trophy? Like, you've got to be frustrated beyond belief if you're that dude, right?
Alonso announced he's staying, so it might be an uphill battle for one more season there.
Wait, he announced he's staying? I missed this.
Correct.
He's staying at Leverkusen?
Yeah, and the conspiracy theorists in us are suspecting that it's because he's waiting to go directly to Real Madrid.
What?
Yeah. But
this opens up an entire can of worms that I was unprepared for. Who's going to be managing Liverpool next season? Do we have any clue? I mean, it's not going to be Thomas Frank.
No, great question. No idea. I mean, obviously, De Zerbi is one of the more popular names. I think there's a few managers in Italy that are all going to be highlighted for job openings. But yeah, it'll be very curious. I can't believe he turned down both.
It seems that Ruben Amorim is the overwhelming favorite at this point. I guess we need to dive into that. Do you think that's a good fit? Do you think that that's the right hire? I mean, he's 4-5 currently.
I don't watch enough Premier League to quite know, but he's very much a hot commodity. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, we'll do a deep dive into that on the next pod. My God. But let's speed through the next few. Real Madrid, Manchester City, even though I picked Real Madrid to win this fixture and they are playing at home, I think given the Real Madrid magic and given their pretty heavy underdogs here and the injuries involved, do you gun for it here? Because you can't really expect to win it at the Etihad, or do you play a certain kind of calculated style of football and just hope you can get a counterattacking goal?
I don't know. Don Carlo's kind of patient and pragmatic in these scenarios, but I think with the Walker and Stones injuries and possibly Ederson as well, it kind of gives Real Madrid the, like, green light to go for it. And I completely agree. Like, you don't want to go to the Etihad needing a result. So I think that that's pretty imperative. They try and take advantage of that. I mean, Kyle Walker's like the one thing that can erase Vinicius on the wing. And Stones is kind of the little secret ingredient to make the midfield with Rodri be so impeccable, especially their rest defense. So I think Real Madrid should take advantage of this for sure at home.
Yeah, moving along, Wednesday, April 10th. Does PSG know how to do anything but blitz? And I think they'll, I think in both fixtures, they'll try to run Barcelona out of the stadium, right?
Yeah, I would think so. And when this fixture came out, I thought that PSG would be handily the favorite. It's really close now. I think it's minus 115 to minus 105 for Barcelona to advance. And since Xavi announced he's leaving and we called them a crisis club, us and everybody else, I think they were 5-3 losers to Villarreal. They're 11 matches unbeaten. So this is getting a little bit closer. I'm pretty sure Barcelona has a couple injuries and suspensions that they have to navigate here. And I think PSG is just a little bit better. Plus, they have the best player. But Lua's kind of started to come around in the springtime. And I don't know, it's closer than it looked. But I'm still with you. I think PSG's got a little bit more, and mostly in the shape of an Mbappe.
Yeah, and then lastly, Atletico Dortmund. Simeone's going to do Simeone things. He's going to make damn sure they don't concede, but give them everything that they can to at least have their fair share of getting counterattacks, because you don't want to go to the big yellow wall, even, you know, even on goals, let alone needing a goal to win, right?
Yeah, I feel like Dortmund might be like the value bet of the round, but I just can't see how it happens, and I'm not betting against Simeone in this situation. Still never lost a home at a knockout tie in the Champions League. Like, it just kind of feels like they're magnetized to a semifinal here.
Yeah, agreed completely. Well, when we come back on the Just for Kicks podcast, we will have our game of hacks, which is our prop bets for goal scorers of the week, as well as our best bets for this upcoming week. And we'll also tell you what you should be watching this weekend. And we're back on the Just for Kicks podcast. Before we get into our picks, we're going to do our prop bets. These are the goal scorers you should take this weekend in our weekly game of hacks. I will start out as I somehow have a lead.
Not true.
What? What happened?
Isak scored 3, baby. I'm up 10-8.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Isak scored 3.
Pending Jackson's performance against Manchester United, it's 10-8.
Wow, you have taken a commanding lead. Well, I will fade you in the remaining fixtures as I can. And again, for those keeping score at home, if you have been putting money on our prop bets for goal scorers of the week, you would be far, far, far into the profits at this point. So it would be wise to continue. I'm just pointing this out for those keeping score at home. Through 31 weeks, we have a combined 18 goals?
Correct.
Got it. So now that you've taken a commanding lead because of Isak's hat trick, who you got?
We have 18 goals in what I believe is the highest scoring Premier League season, maybe ever, certainly a long time. But anyway, this week I'm going with Richarlison.
Richarlison? A man after my own heart, who I once picked on this podcast to be the gold boot winner at the World Cup. He did score a worldly and a half, but fell quite short of that. Respect the pick. I, in a completely unsophisticated move, am picking Cole Palmer against the Blades. Chelsea, if you can't score against the Blades, what can you do? And Cole Palmer has been the catalyst, and he's been the man finding the back of the net, and he takes penalties. This one makes too much sense. So that's my pick as I try to climb back into this match that I've been leading for so long. But now Isak, a man who once propelled me to the front of this competition, has now conversely broken my heart. Steve, I defer to you. What are the best picks of the week?
2 for 3 last week. And this week we will be taking Wolves plus 155 against West Ham. Burnley-Everton draw, plus 290. And finally, Fulham at home, plus 150 against Newcastle.
I like those odds. I like those odds. It always makes me uncomfortable shading Newcastle because of what they're possible. But Fulham, when you can get a good grasp of what Fulham's going to be doing, you know, you got to ride with it. So what are you going to be watching this weekend? I know what I'm going to be watching. Brighton is going to be hosting Arsenal. It's going to be Saturday, April 6th at 12:30 p.m. You can catch that on USA. Brighton is always a scrappy side, even though they've been underachieving this year. They, you know, have been known to scare Liverpool like they did this last week, which could have seriously shaken up the title race. And then we're going to have one of the biggest rivalries in the history of sport, let alone the English Premier League. 10:30 a.m. Eastern, Manchester United takes on Liverpool. That is going to be broadcast on NBC, as well as if for some reason you can't find NBC, it'll also be on USA. So high stakes for Liverpool, traveling to Old Trafford. And unless they somehow can't get past the Blades, they'll be carrying the heavy crown of being leaders in the Premier League into that match. Steve, any other fixtures you want to point out?
Yeah, obviously the Premier League title race, be keeping tabs on all those matches. But after that on Saturday and before the final four, when you're at the bar, little house party, throw in the Copa del Rey final, 1 o'clock Eastern, ESPN Plus, Athletic Club Bilbao versus Mallorca. I would say underdogs in this competition, but kind of romantic stories. Athletic's last major trophy was 1983-84 domestic double. Mallorca is having a pretty tough season. Their last trophy was the 2003 Copa del Rey itself. In any case, should be fun little cup final for Spain.
That's going to be a fun one. What is that? Saturday at 4?
Sorry, I said 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern.
That'll be Saturday at 4. Hang around to check that one out. So before we leave our listeners with an incredible Premier League slate, and an equally exciting midweek for our Champions League quarterfinals. You have anything else, any stats, any shout-outs before we go?
Yeah, back to Leverkusen real quick. They had a come-from-behind win against Offenheim after 2 goals in the last 5-8 minutes to stay undefeated. They have 7 games left, 13 points ahead. Tuchel's all but conceded the title race, but they are now 30 games unbeaten, which is extending the Bundesliga record. They have 23 wins this season. The record is 29 by the Jupp Heynckes and Pep Guardiola Bayern Munich teams. So it's kind of Bayer Leverkusen against history at this point. Should be keeping tabs on that.
Indeed. As much as we want to throw stones at Bayern Munich, what Leverkusen is accomplishing is simply remarkable and probably better contextualizes what's going on at Bayern Munich. It's not necessarily the biggest fail of all time. They're just competing against a historically great side. So this Bundesliga title race continues to be one for the ages.
The knock-on of the Alonso news is it'll be very exciting to see an Alonso Leverkusen in the Champions League next year, because I was nervous we were not going to get that. And I'm very pleased on that front. Hopefully they can stay together. Unlike last year's romantic Napoli side, I would love to see Leverkusen kind of see what they can do against the big boys, because I think they would have done really well this season. They've been definitely one of the best teams in Europe.
Yeah, if they can keep the titans of that side on the field for a Champions League campaign, I don't know what their ceiling is. You know, Napoli obviously got pillaged, changed managers. So we really didn't get to see, you know, what they were capable of on the European front. But that is,
I mean, Leverkusen's definitely a quarterfinal level team, probably would like their chances to make a semifinal. And I'm excited to watch them try because they're that good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I take Arsenal over them on a neutral field, probably. I take Real against them on a neutral field, probably. I take City, I take Liverpool, who aren't even in the Champions League. But beyond that,
it's a short list.
I mean, maybe PSG, but like maybe?
Yeah, it's a real short list.
It's really hard to say that anybody is definitively better than them considering what they've put together this entire campaign. And that includes City.
Completely agree.
That includes Arsenal. I wish they were in it this year.
Really revitalized the Bundesliga, in my opinion. But
yeah. No. Totally. It's not only a one, and if they weren't great, this would still be a 2-horse, maybe 3-horse race. But the fact that Alonso's sticking around for another year means Bayern's going to have to be incredibly creative next year, because, you know, no one in the Munich brass wants to see them go 2 years without a trophy. And Alonso staying, that's a statement of intent. And we shall see what happens. So thanks for listening to the Just for Kicks podcast. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, where we are the Just for Kicks podcast. You can check us out on the artist formerly known as Twitter, now known as X, where we are Just for Kicks FC. Check us out on TikTok, where we are Just for Kicks podcast. And if you are not sophisticated enough to use any of the wonderful DSPs that the podcasting universe provides you, like Spotify, like Apple Music, you can go straight to justforkicks.soccer and get all our episodes straight from our RSS feed and listen to them all. Doesn't matter. Outdated. Steve and I.
Evergreen. This is an evergreen podcast.
It's evergreen. This is an evergreen podcast. Even though we do try to keep things current, our banter delves back into the depths of history. There's always something to learn. So that's the content we provide you because we love you. We love you deeply, and we'll continue to provide you with such evergreen content that also simultaneously is incredibly current, because this is the greatest podcast in the history of mankind. And when aliens inhabit this earth, hundreds or thousands or millions of years from now, they will be studying this podcast clearly as case one of the entire podcast sphere because of how great it is. So if you'd like to argue with that, I will meet you with fisticuffs down at Boston Commons.
Temecula?
Yes, exactly. So good night, good luck, and on an unrelated note, I hope you're enjoying the beginning of the MLB baseball season, because as Yankees, we certainly are on this side of the pond. Good night and God bless.